I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
This is the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Goodison Park.
Hello everybody and welcome to the latest episode of the Royal Blue Podcast. I'm your host Conor O'Neill, joined today by the Echo's Everton correspondent, both home and away, Joe Thomas, as we reflect on the club's mid-season tour to Australia, the FA Cup draw, which obviously is not too kind to the Blues, which was made on Monday night, and look ahead of what's to come in the coming weeks as the World Cup takes centre stage in the footballing calendar. But today, me and Joe will look back on the club's mid-season tour of Australia, as I said, as Joe was the only British journalist out there covering the Blues for the whole duration of the trip. Joe, start off with then, how was Bondi Beach?
Yeah, Bondi Beach was pretty nice, to be fair. Don't want anyone to think that it was too much of a jolly, but...
Yeah, if I was our listener, Joe Watt didn't spend his whole trip on the beach.
I did have a little window of opportunity. I was out, for anybody that was listening, I wasn't out there as long as the club. I got there on Saturday morning and then I came back first thing Thursday morning. So I arrived Saturday morning, there was game on Sunday, had Monday and Tuesday, game on Wednesday, and I basically left the Combank Stadium after the 5-1 win over Western Sydney Wanderers about 11 o'clock on Wednesday night, Australian time. It's about an hour outside central Sydney. And pretty much got back to my hotel and then checked out and then went to the airport straight away. So there was a lot of writing and reporting being done in the back of taxis and on trains and things like that. And whilst I was packing my luggage away, but obviously it was a privilege to be able to go out there and you know, it's a privilege to have a job following the Blues in general. Everton are a massive, massive club. So many people want to detract from them and things like that. But, you know, they're still an absolutely huge, huge club. And being able to follow them and get paid to watch them is just an absolute... And meet so many fans is just something that I'm so grateful to do and very appreciative of. And, you know, obviously, you know, managed to find some little windows of opportunity to do a little bit of sightseeing in Australia. But really, it was a case of, you know, this was a rare opportunity. I mean, obviously, we're in unprecedented times of a break in mid-season, but with the way that the season, or the first part of the season, did end with Leicester, Bournemouth, and bearing in mind we know what happened last year and we know what awaits us when Everton return on Boxing Day, actually, it felt like quite a significant time to be able to go out there and speak to the people, you know, in the know, really, that you know, get a glimpse inside, you know, behind the curtains of what's going on in that dressing room, really, because as much as a lot of Everton fans completely understandably might want to just draw the curtains and just try and ignore football for the next few weeks, these are actually really, really significant times. You know, I don't think anybody can be under any illusion that Everton are in a battle this season. Hopefully it's one that they'll be able to pull away from sooner rather than later and not end up in a situation like they were last season. But the way that final week went and the way the momentum was just as coming into this break, you know, I think a lot of us have got serious concerns. So I actually think it was quite important to be out there just to be able to, you know, to have that opportunity to speak to the likes of Frank Lampard and some of the players, other people, get a glimpse of what was going on and be able to report it back, really. Because obviously a lot of people are worried and they want to know what the thought process is behind a lot of things and what the plan is as well. And hopefully, if you've read any of my reporting, and hopefully because you're listening to this, we'll be able to kind of give you that little bit of insight, hopefully. So,
I just think to start with, though, obviously, you know, you alluded to there in terms of Everton headed down under, having lost three games on the bounce. They weren't exactly very inspiring performances from Frank Lampard's side, neither one of the games. There's a lot of talk about the trip and why, you know, some fans question why, you know, a mid-season jolly up, in some people's words, was needed to Australia. You know, they should be on the training ground doing a lot of work. But you wrote this in your Royal Blue, you know, before the games kicked off. But this was important for Everton to make, wasn't it? Not just, you know, on the pitch, a bit of bonding together, but also off the pitch commercially and becoming a stronger entity as a brand.
Yeah, I really think this was a good thing. The timing wasn't great. And from a PR point of view, the way in which things coincided, you know, the optics weren't wonderful. And I think, you know, if you were working for Everton that week after the last Bournemouth defeat, and you're there thinking, right, I've got to kind of now start putting stuff out about the players being on Bondi Beach doing yoga and, you know, out and about in Australia, I think you know that the replies on social media aren't going to be particularly great. But for me, this was a sensible thing to do, and it was a good thing. So obviously, the agreements go out there in the first place was signed a long, long time ago. You know, I haven't just gone, oh, we've had a really bad week, let's run to the other side of the world and try and escape it all. You know, this is an agreement that's been in place for some time. And, you know, the reality is that Everton got 6 weeks to fill from Bournemouth to Wolves. They were always going to do a lot of training in between. They were always going to go and do warm weather training, really. I think most Premier League clubs would do something out in the Middle East or elsewhere where they go and, you know, do some training in better climates. And, you know, we've seen that with other teams. I mean, even sort of Sunderland, Ellis Sims for Sunderland's out in Dubai, or he was out in Dubai last week. So, you know, they're a kind of, you know, a mid-table championship club. So Everton were always going to go and do some warm weather training. That was always going to cost money as well. I mean, this way they managed to go and do that warm weather training, play semi-competitive matches and actually get paid for it. You know, a lot of people in the summer, there were a lot of sticks to beat Everton with. And one of them was the kind of the commercial performance of the club, the idea that it wasn't seeking to maximise its opportunities. Well, and signing up for this trip, they've gone over there. As I say, they've saved money with the warm weather camp, but they've made money as well. You know, there's a seven-figure profit that's been made from this trip. So after all the expenses of going out there and team hotels and things like that, you know, it's £1 million plus. And when you look at things like financial, you know, fair play, the profit and sustainability things, when you look at the fact that this is a January transfer window that's coming up, which is, you know, money is going to be tight, but business clearly needs to be done, things like that matter. And then the other thing as well is it's good for the brand. You know, it takes Everton to an audience that they haven't been to for quite some time. You know, get to re-engage with fans that, you know, don't normally get to see them. And they get to promote themselves, as I say, to a brand new audience. And, you know, I can understand the unease that some fans might have felt when, you know, we're still scarred by that double defeat in Bournemouth. You know, especially fans that travelled 1,000 miles in 5 days to watch those two atrocious performances. I can understand when less than a week later they're looking at pictures of players doing yoga on Bondi Beach and thinking, oh, you know, I'm not sure what I really think about this. But if you get away from that and take a step back, like, I think that it was a good thing for the club to be doing. And ultimately, you know, and we'll get on to this, I think it probably did end up being a decent trip for morale and a few of the players as well. So
you speak there, Joe, about, you know, morale, but, you know, when you first arrived in Australia and obviously, you know, ahead of the first game and stuff, what was the mood in the camp, you sense? Because obviously, like you say, you know, Everton did arrive in Australia on the back of 3 straight defeats. A lot of worried people still to this day who think that, no, it's going to be another long few hard months to come once the football resumes. What was the mood in and around the camp? Because obviously, you know, it's tough for fans to take, but it can also be tough for players and coaching staff to take what they'd witnessed in the 7 days, you know, before the football, domestic football season ended.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, going into the Celtic game, I think there was a degree of concern, really, because, you know, we'll have all seen it that week. The squad that Everton took to Australia wasn't the strongest squad. Now, they couldn't do a lot about that. Obviously, you know, you had Onana, Cody, Pickford and Gay are all out on World Cup duty. So that's 4 of the starting 11 are gone. You know, Iwobi and Coleman and Rondon as well were out on international duty. I don't really know the thought process, because obviously Nathan Patterson was due to play for Scotland in friendlies, but he went on the trip in the same way that Celtic pulled a lot of their Scottish internationals away from that squad so they could make it on the trip. I don't quite know what the conversations were between, are you going to come or are you not if you're on international friendly duty. Obviously, someone like Seamus Coleman, club captain, it's important he goes out there, but also bearing in mind the stage he's at in his career, I don't think it's unfair to say that it probably won't get too many more opportunities to go out and represent his country. So that would have been important for him. Then you look at the injury situations as well. So you have James Garner out injured, Dominic Calvert-Lewin out injured. You know, it kind of, and then you had Ben Godfrey, and obviously fielded some questions around Godfrey being there. Godfrey didn't go because of a setback in injury or his recovery or anything like that. He didn't go for personal reasons, which, you know, perfectly legitimate, and which I won't go into more detail unless he puts them out there himself. So you kind of ended up there with a real makeshift squad, obviously it filled with under-21s as well. And under-21s, like to Tom Cannon, Stan Mills, got opportunities against Bournemouth in the last week before the break. And they have been subject to some calls for them to be involved in first team action, particularly Tom Cannon, because we can all see that Everton are struggling for goals up top. And one thing he is a goal scorer. The question with him is, where is he at in terms of his development, and what can he do at a senior level, and what can he do at potentially in the Premier League? And obviously there are understandable questions about that because he's still only 19. But it was an opportunity for them. But I think going into Celtic, see, this was Ange Post. Yeah, the trip was always going to be around Celtic. Celtic were one of the first teams to sign up. It was initially going to be them and Rangers, not them and Everton. Rangers pulled out because they thought it was effectively going to be a big fanfare for the Australian Ange Postecoglou's homecoming back to Australia, glorious homecoming, and they were going to be bit part players. So I think because of that, because of the sentimental value this trip had to Ange, I think Celtic were taking it reasonably seriously. Had they pulled players out of the Scotland squad, and had a reasonably strong side. So I think there was a degree of concern, I think, from within the Everton camp that they'd had a really bad last week before the break. They were going out to Australia with a makeshift squad. They were going to play Champions League opposition that were up for it. What Everton could really have done without would be a situation where they go and put in a disappointing position and get played off the park by Celtic, which would only just add to everybody's woes. So I think there was a little bit of concern. Obviously, they were aware of the optics of going out there in the first place, so even though it's outside their control, but bearing in mind where the momentum was heading, they were already aware of that. I think there was a degree of kind of concern, maybe from not necessarily within the dressing room as such, but more from probably the wider club side as to what might unfold on this trip. Obviously, it didn't end up that way. Within the camp itself, I think there was a degree of, and I say this within the dressing room, within Frank Lampard and within some of the players, I think there was a sense that it was a good time for a break and a good time to kind of take a step back and just reflect on where things might have been going wrong for the last few weeks. And a degree of hope that it presented an opportunity to kind of carry on working on some of those areas. Everton had a weakened side, but they did have if you take Dominic Calvert-Lewin out of it, they did have what is essentially their first choice attack out there. Neil Mopai, Anthony Gordon, Damari Gray, Dwight McNeil. This was an opportunity for them to carry on working together, try and figure themselves out. Obviously, McNeil and Mopé are still very new to that squad. Gray and Gordon are being asked to play very, very different roles to what they have done for Everton, or certainly were to do for Everton last season. So, I think there was a sense that this could be a good thing, but that was also tinged with the nerves as what could happen if things went wrong against Celtic.
Obviously, just on the Celtic game then, not a classic, I don't think, by any means. Not one that'll live long in the memory. But it will live long in the memory for one man called Isaac Price, who I think it's safe to say stole the show.
Absolutely. I mean, if nobody had a better tour than Isaac Price. And, we're speaking here on Tuesday. If you pick up the Echo today or go online, I've got a big exclusive interview with Isaac speaking to him after he then had another excellent 90 minutes in the Western Sydney Wanderers game. He was always, according to Frank, he was always going to get minutes in the Celtic game because the way he's been performing, not just for the under-21s, but when he's trained with the first team. But that became even more likely with the unfortunate news that Tom Davis was going to have to fly home because of a knee issue just that he sustained the day before the Celtic game. So, I mean, we've already spoken about the makeshift makeup of that Everton squad. Well, come kickoff at the Accor Stadium against Celtic, Everton only had two recognised central midfielders in that whole squad. Abdoulaye Doucouré and under-21 star Isaac Price. So I think that it was clearly a big opportunity for him, but I mean, it was one that he really did excel. I mean, there's been a lot of excitement around Isaac Price. It's been quite interesting, really, when I think the back end of last season, Isaac Price was probably at the forefront of the crop of under-21s that are coming through when it comes to first team fixtures in mind. I think so. He got his debut against Arsenal. The last game of the season, came off the last 12 minutes and then went off to the summer. He was one of the ones that went out to America, but it felt that in America it was really a case of Stan Mills and Lewis Warrington stealing the show, maybe a bit of Reece Welsh as well. And they continued to do so when we came back to England and carried on with the friendlies. So it felt like the momentum went away from Isaac Price. But what was interesting was in the first part of this season, whenever you spoke to Frank about, you know, what's going on with Warrants and what's going on with Mills, what's going on with, say, Cannon or Welch, he would always, as part of his response, he would always bring Isaac Price's name into the conversation. So if somebody else hadn't mentioned it, he would bring Isaac Price in. I think he's clearly very highly thought of in the squad and the back room. And obviously he got his chance and, you know, he was the bright spark. Obviously the Celtic performance wasn't particularly good. It was more of what we've seen. You know, Everton kind of struggled to exert any control over that game. Didn't really win the midfield battle, but in fairness to them, they also weren't cut open particularly. You know, they didn't concede a lot of clear-cut opportunities, and they did spring a couple of useful counter-attacks. They did pose a threat throughout that game. They did create good opportunities, which obviously development and what we've seen towards the back end of that, of the fixtures before the break. And Isaac Price throughout all this, you know, especially bearing in mind Abdoulaye Doucouré went off at half-time, so Isaac Price ended up being the only recognised centre midfielder in the midfield three of him and the two wingers, McNeil and Gordon, against Champions League opposition, who were taking the game seriously. And, you know, he never looked out of place. You know, he was very good.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
I've got to ask, because there was some raised eyebrows, I think, and some amusement from Everton supporters saying it on social media. How did Everton win the City Super Cup after playing one match?
Yeah.
It was announced during after the Celtic game when they won on penalties that they had won the City Super Cup, but they still have one more game to play against the team who'd already beat Celtic. So technically, you know, what was your understanding of the stadium? Obviously, you know
one of the for people who've been listening and following the Echo's coverage of Everton for a long time, I know that I only took up this job at the back end of March, beginning of April last year. But my background is a news journalist and finding things out and getting to the truth, getting to the bottom of things. And, you know, in the lines of work that I've done for the past 12 years or so, it's not always easy, but normally you can get to a right answer. Normally there's a document you can find, something, or a court case you can follow, or something else like that. In football journalism, it's almost more like politics. Like, things are so, so grey. And sometimes, no one's willing to give you an answer, you just can't get it. And I've been asking, what is the format of the Sydney Super Cup? How can somebody, well, one, is there a piece of silverware? And two, how do you win it or win the title in a scenario where you have three games between four sides? And, you know, it was bizarre. And nobody would ever come back to me with an answer. So even going into that Celtic game, obviously Celtic had already lost their first game against Sydney FC, which obviously came as a surprise. And I was sitting there against, so yeah, you were there thinking, well, I mean, if Everton were to win this game against Celtic, they must have a decent chance, because Celtic wouldn't be able to win it, at least. So going into that game, I still didn't have the answer. You know, I'd gone to the club, I'd gone to tournament organisers, and then with about 10 minutes to go in that match, you know, sitting in the press box, and there was me, and then, you know, obviously, as we said, I was the only dedicated Everton reporter out there. There were a couple of dedicated Celtic reporters there from the Scottish press, and one or two kind of local Australian reporters, just kind of, you know, they're covering the thing for their local newspapers and websites and things like that. And about 10, 15 minutes ago in the Celtic match, obviously it was 0-0, and all of a sudden we started getting these Tano announcements saying, oh, you know, if nobody can find a winner, there'll be a penalty shootout to decide who wins the Sydney Super Cup. And we were all looking at each other in the press box thinking, all right. Weren't expecting this, didn't know there were going to be penalties. You know, I've since asked Everton whether or not they knew there was a penalty shootout, and the suggestion seems to be that they kind of found out late on the day, you know, maybe just as they were kind of going through the warm-ups and stuff like that. They certainly didn't have a list. You know, when it came to who the penalty takers were, it was a case of the players who were on the pitch at the full-time whistle volunteering to Frank. You know, and obviously several of them told me that. Nathan Patterson told me that, Tom Cannon, Stan Mills all told me that, because they're three of the penalty takers for Everton. So, you know, there was no like big plan to go in, and there was no, oh, I better bring on so-and-so with 5 minutes to go because he's a great penalty taker or anything like that. It really was a kind of a bizarre scenario. I mean, I must admit, it was actually quite a welcome one for me because, you know, with 10 minutes to go, like, you know, part of my insight into my job, part of my job is to basically have a match report that is coherent and far, normally somewhere between about 800 and 1,000 words long, that's normally far about 15 minutes after kickoff, 15, 20 minutes after, sorry, after the final whistle. And I was there, and obviously I had the body of the report, but in terms of what the actual story, what the headline, what the main, my main takeaway was going to be, I was struggling because it was essentially a 0-0 draw in which Everton hadn't particularly excelled, but they had, you know, created a few opportunities, but it was a struggle. So being able to, you know, 20 minutes later, right, that Anthony Gordon kept his composure to roll in a penalty and seal Everton as Sydney Super Cup champions, obviously made my job a lot easier. So, and it certainly became easier as the penalty shootout, you know, unfolded, because very, very quickly Everton had the initiative. So it didn't really feel there's any jeopardy in it.
Obviously, you know, in terms of the downtime or emotional between the Celtic game and the Western Sydney game, a lot of people probably would have imagined that you were out shopping, you know, sightseeing. Mm. But it was obviously a very busy time for you over in Australia. Obviously, you fortunate us to get some time with Frank Lampard. Obviously, you know, we put two exclusives out over in the Echo paper over the weekend, and they're still on the site now, which if no one's read them. But how did you find, you know, how was Frank? You know, what was his mood? What was, you know, his feeling? Because obviously, you know, like we've always alluded to, it must be a bit of a stressful, concerning time for him heading over to Australia after what he's witnessed in them three games in the build-up.
Yeah, well, because I spoke to him after the Celtic game, which he was, you know, relatively pleased that he'd led Everton to Sydney Super Cup glory. And that was a Sunday night in Australia, and then the game was on the Wednesday. So Monday, you know, the squad had a day off, essentially. Then Tuesday, involved a bit of training. So, yeah, for the Monday and Tuesday, for me, was very much a case of, you know, for people who were listening and not sure how this works, you know, I'm completely independent from Everton. I haven't travelled out there with the squad or anything like that. And I haven't gone out there with the promise of any access or anything like that. It's very much a case of, you know, the Echo independently paid to send a reporter out there, and it's a case of trying to get as much as you can, and, you know, essentially trying to, you know, obviously put requests into the club and see if you'll be able to get people speaking to you. You know that you'll have the framework of the two matches, which obviously Everton don't control whether or not you can go to them. So, you know, you'll be able to report on them, have the press conferences after. So worst comes to worst, you know, you'll get Frank after those games. And then you know that there's a degree of kind of almost public relations opportunities, things like that, open training sessions, things that the organisers put on. So, for instance, the organisers in between the Celtic match and the Western Sydney Wanderers match kind of put on their own little press call with Ashley Cole. So, you know, that was an opportunity for me to speak to Ashley Cole without having to go through the club. But anything beyond that is very much a case of me going out there and trying to have to make the most of it. One of the things I was trying to do out when I was out there and failed was Jack Rodwell plays for Sydney FC. So I was trying to see if I could sit down with him. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get that access. But I was able, you know, very lucky, very fortunate to, you know, to get a lot of time with Everton's players, and particularly with Everton's backroom staff. You know, they were quite generous. I was pleased, I think, not necessarily surprised, but pleased that they were willing to be so open. It was quite a difficult time. I think, you know, they're able to give me a bit of access and a bit of, so I could get a bit of insight into what the, you know, what the thought process was at the club. And, you know, like you alluded to there, you know, I got 40 minutes to sit down with Frank Lampard, and, you know, it was a 40 minutes that, like, I took seriously. You know, I haven't gone out there just to say, you know, oh, you're great and things like that. You know, I've gone and asked him what he thinks about the World Cup and England's chances, because, you know, people listening to this, that's not really top of their agenda. Top of their agenda, same for me. It's got 6 weeks here where Everton are 1 point and one place above the relegation. So I want to know what's happening. How are you going to fix it? What's you know, what do you think about now, and what's your plan to kind of improve things? And, you know, luckily I was able to put those questions to him and got what I think were relatively straight answers. You know, people can, you know, implore people to read what he says, and then they can come to their own conclusions as to whether or not they agree with what Frank says. But at least, you know, by going out there, we've had the opportunity to ask those questions, and you know, fans could at least get an insight into the thought process. So, you know, it was quite interesting. It was really interesting. And this wasn't just from Frank, but when I look back on that last week before the World Cup break, you know, I look at there was the Leicester game, the Bournemouth game, and the Bournemouth game. And for me, it was a bad weekend. It was three bad games. I think the first line of my match report from the Leicester game was it was Everton's most disappointing performance of the season so far. And I genuinely felt that. And it can be hard sometimes because, you know, you're on the spot and, you know, a couple of hours later, you might watch some highlights or have a little think about what Frank said after the game or something like that. And, you know, come to slightly different conclusions. But, you know, a couple of hours later, your match report's essentially redundant. But, you know, I still felt that because I we had the Palace game where they played so well. We had the Fulham game where they struggled a little bit, but they showed a lot of resilience. And then, you know, going into that Leicester game, it just felt always going to be a tough opposition. But if Everton won, they were going to be in the top half of the table. And that felt realistic at the time. It didn't feel daft. And I felt that Everton were comprehensively beaten, if I'm honest. So one of the things that I was asking Frank was, I got the sense that there's no hiding away from the Bournemouth games, particularly the last game. But I feel a sense in the camp that the Leicester game isn't part of that bad week or that negative momentum. The Leicester game, I think they see as what was actually a performance in which the players had done what the backroom staff had asked them to do. The game plan had, to a certain extent, worked. You know, the 50-50 just hadn't gone their way. So, you know, and I was asking Frank about this, like, why do you have that mindset? Because, you know, I'm not going to pretend I'm particularly good tactical analysis or anything like that. But as I say, it felt disappointing to me. And his view was, well, look, set the team up in a way that I thought would be effective. And I think they were effective. He was saying, you know, first 5 minutes, create that golden opportunity. Alex Iwobi puts it wide. Well, if Alex Iwobi scores, it's a different game. You know, get through the first half, 0-0 going 5 minutes, Yuri Thielmann scores an absolute worldie to separate the side. Sometimes you have to put your hands up and say, you know, there's only so much you can do. We've had a great chance, we've missed it. We're 0-0, we're competitive. And then someone does something sensational like that. Okay, half-time, regroup, get the players in again, ask them to do a job. They come out, they do it straight away again because Dominic Calvert-Lewin has a one-on-one. If he scores that, changes the game again. Obviously, he didn't. And then, you know, the second half was end-to-end and a bit more even than the first half. But, you know, the second goal ultimately did just come from Everton committing players forward in order to try and get an equaliser, at the death. But I found really interesting that because, as I say, from my point of view, I found it quite a disappointing performance. But from their point of view, the team had done what they'd asked them to do and it was fine. It was fine margins. And fine margins has been a theme of Everton's season, and more often than not, they've gone against them. But I can at least understand his point of view, even if I don't necessarily, you know, fully agree with it. Like, I thought Everton were outplayed in that first half, but I can at least see where the positives that they're trying to take from it are. And the other thing that I asked him about was, we saw this replication in the Bournemouth game the following Saturday in the Premier League, was the position of Amadou Onana. You know, in both those games, he played much further forward, and it felt like Everton had been really solid against Crystal Palace or West Ham when Onana and Idrissa Gueye played in front of the back four and you know, kind of almost had a defensive mindset. That felt the you know, almost the best way to do it. And then in that last week, this before the break, he pushed Onana up, and it just felt that, you know, once Bournemouth or Leicester beat that initial press, it did feel like, you know, Everton's midfield was overrun. And, you know, basically Frank's explanation, and he was quite honest, and I think the honesty has to be applauded to a little bit. He basically said, we're still trying to work out what to do with Amadou Onana, where the most effective way of using him. And it all comes down to essentially space of about 10 yards. Where in that 10 yards do you want him to be between Iwobi and Gueye? You know, Frank Lampard's, he's reluctant to move Alex Iwobi from an advanced central midfielder from an 8 into a 10 because he thinks he can do such a good job more in the middle third of the pitch. Obviously, he's using Idrissa Gueye as a 6. And as I say, he's trying to work out what's best to do with Onana. And I think the thought process is that, yes, Everton are more defensively solid when Onana and Gueye are playing alongside each other. But it does also, bearing in mind how kind of disjointed the attack has been this season, it does also lead to difficult games where they don't create very much. The Newcastle game being probably the worst one, where Everton were quite solid. I mean, it was only a very good goal from Almiron that beat them. but they just didn't create anything at all. And I think, you know, I think Frank's head at the minute, and obviously this, I think there's a degree of trying to almost think, overthinking Onana's role, because they haven't quite worked out how the wingers and Mope are linking up, you know, in the absence of Dominic Calvert-Lewin. But I think they're trying to find a way in which they have more attacking options and threat and ability to play between the lines and against, say, Newcastle, and therefore moving forward. But I think there's awareness that if they push him too far forward, then there's a danger that, say, like Leicester or Bournemouth, then, you know, he can get taken out by some slick passing, and then Everton are exposed. So I think, you know, with that, obviously, you've got to remember Amadou Onana is only 21 years old. He's only a couple of months into his Premier League season. You know, he's still in an Everton side where Alex Iwobi's playing in centre midfield for the first time probably in his career. And Idrissa Gueye has come back into a new squad. And he's got Dwight McNeil around him, who's new to the squad. He's got two centre-backs behind him that are new to the squad. He's got Mope in front of him that's new to the squad. You know, like, I think there's just a few growing pains and teething problems. Frank Lampard's very keen to change the style of that into a far more progressive style. Amadou Onana will be crucial to that. But I think they're just learning at the minute. They've got no choice having to figure it out on the job with him. And I think there's an acceptance that they're still in that learning curve. So that was a very, very long answer to kind of what their thought process in the camp was. But there you go. As for Bournemouth, Bournemouth in the league, there's no hiding from that. They were just very, very disappointed with that performance.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
In terms of, you know, for anyone who's read the, I think it's the second part, but excuse me if I'm wrong, there are plans afoot already for the January transfer window, and targets and areas have been identified in which they want to improve Frank Lampard's improving squad.
Yeah, absolutely. They have a short list of players. You know, one of the reasons Kevin Fowler didn't go out there, the director of football, is because he was a bit concerned about his ability to make and take important phone calls when, you know, the time difference is 11 hours. And having been out there myself, it was very, very difficult to kind of do anything, you know, linking professionally with home because of that. So I can completely understand that. You know, I think there is a plan. They know that. Yeah, they're under no illusions that they need to kind of strengthen attacking wise. The hope is that they can bring in two attacking players. They have profiles, they have names. I think at the minute they might be making kind of tentative exploratory moves, but the reality is that January is always a notoriously difficult window to do business in. The World Cup's going to make it even harder to do business in. And I think there's a belief that basically no one's really going to be able to start making proper moves until players have started returning back from the World Cup, and they can assess, you know, clubs can assess what their own situations are, because everyone will have their own plans, but a lot of them will be heavily affected by the state their players come back from the World Cup, and whether or not they come out of injuries, whether they come out with fatigue and things like that. So, you know, Everton are exploring attacking signings. We know they need them. There will also be an emphasis on outgoings this January. They secured quite a lot at the back end of the summer transfer window, albeit most of them on loan. You know, I think that there will be significant efforts to try and move squad fringe players on in January. I don't think that's essential to being able to do attacking business in January, but I think if they wanted to look elsewhere within the squad as well, then I think that would be dependent on outgoings. So, you know, but there is, you know, Frank's very clear that there is a plan in place. How it all unfolds, we'll all have to wait and see. There are factors outside of Everton's control at the moment, but I think most fans will be relieved to know that there is a degree of coordination between Frank and Kevin. You know, there is an understanding of what they need to do, and it's the understanding is probably the same as what most fans will have looked at over the last few months and gone, that's it. Everton are probably a bit light on attacking options and they need to address that area, and that's what they're planning to do.
Obviously, I know in terms of the Western Sydney game, it was, you know, comfortable 5-1 win in the end. Anthony Gordon back to hat-trick. Neil Maupay was also on target. But, you know, I think the big moment of the game and the, you know, the real nice moment of the match was Tom Cannon getting his first senior goal for the club. obviously, you know, it capped off what has been quite the month for the youngster when you think of, you know, his first appearance, a brace against Paris Saint-Germain in the Premier League against National Cup under-21s, his first Premier League appearance and now his first goal. It's all just falling nicely for the youngsters. And Joe, and you spoke to him as well after that goal, and, you know, what he must have been buzzing, you know, smiling from ear to ear.
Yeah, I was kind of in the bowels of the Combank Stadium on what was Wednesday night, and came across Tom Cannon, and he was absolutely buzzing. You know, he was over the moon. It was clearly a big moment for him, and it capped off what had been a massive fortnight for him. Obviously, made his senior debut against Bournemouth in the Carabao Cup, made his Premier League debut against Bournemouth the following Saturday, and then obviously came out on this tour, scored a penalty in the penalty shootout against Celtic, and then, you know, had that moment against Western Sydney Wanderers. And, you know, it was just nice. It's nice to be able to, and that was something that was really positive, I think, from the trip in general. The under-21s largely excelled. Stan Mills, Isaac Price, Tom Cannon in particular, you know, they had good trips. And, you know, it feels like Tom Cannon and Stan Mills have kind of almost like almost kind of joined at the hip at the moment. You know, they both came on against Bournemouth in the Cup together. They were both involved in the matchday squad. Obviously, Stan Mills didn't get on in the Premier League game against Bournemouth. And then, you know, they both came on together against Western Sydney Wanderers, and it was Mills who essentially got the assist for Cannon's goal. So, you know, it was a nice moment. He was over the moon with it, I think. You know, it clearly meant a lot to him. You know, lucky enough to speak to Stan Mills, lucky enough to speak to Isaac Price, and I think they were really grateful for the opportunities they got. And, you know, I think it gave them a lot of confidence as well. You know, Tom Cannon's a goal scorer. You'd see that. Obviously, he was predatory instincts in the box to pick up on a goalkeeper mistake for the goal. Probably should have scored, you know, another chance. He had about 15 yards out later on in the game, but put it over. And then, you know, real nice kind of shift of weight on the edge of the box to create half a yard for himself, force a really good save from the keeper later on. Yeah, I think Tom Cannon thinks he's ready to do a job at senior level. He really wants to kind of try and force his way into the Premier League squad as well. I think from what I've seen of Tom Cannon, I remember going to the under-21s and watching under-21s against Man United under-21s kind of at the beginning of the season, game finished 2-2. And obviously we know Man United's academy is one of the most renowned in the world. And just watching Tom Cannon in that game, he just bullied Man United. You know, he got his two goals. He could have had more. He could have had a few assists. You know, from what I've seen of him in the under-21s, he's ready for the step up. And I think he's kind of, we might see this against Mansfield in the Papa John's Trophy. We've seen it in the games at tournaments so far. You know, when he's come up against senior players from lower league opposition, again, he's been competitive. He's been able to hold his own. So whether the next step for him is kind of more involvement in the Premier League with Everton, or perhaps kind of find an opportunity to go out on loan in January, which, especially if Frank's looking to bring in new attackers, might end up being the most plausible kind of move for his development. You know, like, I think there's a player there to get excited about. Obviously, we don't want to put too much pressure on him or anybody else. He's still very, very young and still developing, but he's a goal scorer. He was buzzing after the game. It was a lovely moment, and it was lovely to see how much it meant to him.
No, just to finish up, then, Joe, on, you know, the Australian trip and the tour, I think that'll be the most pleasing thing going for Frank Lampard, is that, you know, he will return to the UK with plenty of, you know, food for thought, and you know, he will have plenty to think about, and he will hope that the confidence gained in them two games over the last, you know, week or so will stand his side in good stead when they, you know, restart their Premier League campaign on Boxing Day against Wolves.
Yeah, no one can, and I don't think anybody is getting carried away or over the top of what happened in Australia. Obviously, you know, there was, yeah, like, you know, it's a makeshift squad, and, you know, they're still kind of, you know, against Celtic, they have still issues that, you know, that we've seen in the Premier Leagues and in the Cup so far this season. I don't think anybody's thinking that, you know, a penalty shootout win over Celtic and, you know, the win over Western Sydney Wanderers is going to pave the way to, you know, it's job done, and they don't have to think about addressing anything else before Wolves. I don't think that's the case at all. But one thing I definitely think is that the squad, the manager, the club as a whole is in a better place for that trip. It could have, you know, we spoke at the beginning, you know, there was a fear it could have gone badly. It didn't go badly at all. It went pretty well. And, you know, as an opportunity to kind of, you know, just take stock on what happened, you know, particularly that last week before the break, as an opportunity to kind of re-engage with a different section of the fan base. There's an opportunity to kind of work on something. You know, there were some nice little link-ups between Mope and Gordon and McNeil and Gray against Western Sydney Wanderers. And we can't read too much into that because obviously, you know, the opposition didn't make it hugely difficult for them. But, you know, on the flip side, it was only in the summer that they went and lost the local opposition, got hammered by Minnesota United 4-0. And, you know, everybody was, and rightly so, everybody was going, oh, that's a real warning sign. So, you know, we know that these things can go badly for Everton. This didn't, and we should take some comfort from that. So, you know, I think it was a, I think it was a good show. I spoke to Neil Mope on the trip as well, and obviously there's been a lot of focus around him and the fact that obviously he got that goal against West Ham, played well in the derby, missed his chance, but played well in the derby, got his goal against West Ham, hasn't really kicked on from there. But yeah, you'll see it in a piece that I'm writing at the moment, so it'll be published in the next coming days. You know, there's a real desperation there from him, a real intent and determination on him to kind of do well, to push on, to want to help Everton. And you know, I think we forget that, you know, Neil Mope has only been at that in that squad for 10 Premier League games. You know, he joined right at the back end of the transfer window. There was an administrative mix-up which prevented him from playing against Leeds. You know, so his debut was against Liverpool. And I think, you know, when you look at Mope, I think one of the things that's probably been difficult for him is the fact that I don't think things have been set up for him to succeed. I think so far there's been a lot of almost playing as if they were playing towards Dominic Calvert-Lewin, except instead of having Dominic Calvert-Lewin, a big powerhouse target man up front, they've had, you know, 5'7" Neil Mope is a completely different player. So, you know, I think there's, whether or not he'll do well at Everton remains to be seen. There's definitely a determination from him to do so. You know, he's working hard and I think he's a positive influence in that camp. So yeah. And the other thing was, it was, you know, both from the club's perspective, I'm sure, but from a personal perspective as well, it was great to go out there and see so many fans, you know, like they, you know, went on a boat trip on Sydney Harbour with 150 Everton fans. There was another trip after that with another 150, and they could have sold another boat. And, you know, I know that when you look at the pictures from the matches, it's not as if the stands are, you know, thronging with people and things like that. But you've got to remember the first game was in an 80,000 capacity stadium, and, you know, 40,000 people were there to watch it. And that's still a hell of a lot of people. And all the events that Everton went to were well attended. You know, there's a good fan base for Everton out in Australia. It's absolutely huge. You know, maybe not, but obviously you have things like the Tim Cahill factor and others, and, you know, stuff like that will only help. And it was nice to, as I say, speak to fans, speak to listeners of this podcast. You know, give a shout out to Rick and his son Owen, who I met before the Western Sydney Wanderers game. You know, it was a real delight and pleasure to meet them and to hear what they think about our coverage and that as well. And just to kind of hear, I found this really interesting in America as well, actually. It's very interesting to hear the perspective of fans that are outside England and watch it from perhaps not quite within the same bubble as to what they think of things as well. So obviously everyone's united, I think, and hoping that, being slightly worried about where Everton are now and hoping that things get better when they resume on Boxing Day against Wolves. But you know, it was a real privilege to go out there and to see, you know, so many fans and meet them, and obviously to follow Everton as well.
Just before we finish, Joel, there was another piece of Everton news that dropped on Monday night. Me and you spoke at length yesterday in the office about Everton hopefully getting an ideal FA Cup draw and what that would mean. I think we can both agree Manchester United's away is far from ideal.
Yeah, it's a disaster, isn't it? I mean, and Everton shouldn't have any real fear going into that. Manchester United are a side that I think Everton can go toe-to-toe with. It's another very difficult game. It's another scenario. It feels like there's a lot of this for Everton at the moment. I'm sure a lot of supporters will say it goes back years and years and years, but like every time there's an opportunity for things to go Everton's way, they don't tend to. You know, things kind of, I'm not saying they conspire against Everton, but there's nothing's ever easy for the club. You know, January looks like a very big month for Everton, and it looks like it has the potential to be a very big month for Frank Lampard. You know, that Wolves game when they go back is huge. And then it's followed by Man City, which I suppose is, to some extent, is a free hit. But obviously, you know, is a game they're not necessarily expected to get points out of. So if they don't beat Wolves, there's every chance that come Man City, after the Man City game, they're in the relegation zone. and then with a big game to Brighton, then following a big game against Southampton, and what could be a massive game against West Ham. You know, I'm looking at that game in mid-January and thinking, depending on how the teams restart, that could be a make-or-break game for Lampard or Moyes. Whether, you know, we can, close to the time, and hopefully it doesn't get there for Frank, we can discuss the merits as to whether or not it should be. Personally, I think Everton are in a scenario where they need to have patience in a manager and give somebody time to turn things around. The time means multiple transfer windows. You know, if Everton wants sustainable progress, there is, and Frank made this point out there, saying, you know, there are going to be difficult moments throughout this journey. You know, no matter who, and I think that's the case for no matter who's in charge, no matter how much money they have, and nobody else would get any different kind of backing financially. You know, there are going to be difficult moments for Everton as they look to kind of, you know, turn the ship around and have sustainable progress. But he could well be under a bit of pressure come early January. And, you know, yeah, I was just thinking it would be, you know, you can obviously Everton can't take anything for granted. We know that, but nice home game against the lower league opposition on the 7th of January, and might be an opportunity for reflection, for a bit of a morale boost and win or something like that, just to kind of ease a little bit of the pressure. And, you know, instead Everton have had that, probably got the one in 7 or 8 fixtures that they could probably do without. And, you know, again, a difficult January starts to look even more difficult. I don't know, what are your thoughts on it, Connor?
I was not impressed when it was drawn out last night, it's safe to say. I do buy the thing, you know, you've got to beat someone, you've got to beat decent teams along the way if you're going to win the cup, you know, that is true, you know, you've got to beat someone. But I thought, you know, considering that all the ties Everton could have had, I think that's one of the toughest, isn't it, that, you know, they could have been drawn against them. You know, it just kind of makes, like you say there, it makes January even bigger now, doesn't it, because, you know, you don't want to get in a position where, you know, you're out the FA Cup, you're fighting relegation, having already been knocked out the League Cup the way we was, you know, it's far from ideal, I think, is the way to look at it. But, you know, Everton have got to go there, they've got to believe, and they've got to show that they can compete with these teams, haven't they? You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, like I say, if you're going to win the Cup, you've got to beat someone good at some point. So, you know, there's no better place to start than Old Trafford in the third round.
Yeah, and I do think Frank Lampard will take that game very seriously as well. You know, I think there are a few kind of, you know, when they saw the Carabao Cup team, the 11 changes in the performance that followed, I think there was a bit of frustration. Obviously, you know, we know about Everton's, you know, long wait for success and silverware, and, you know, determination from fans not to just give up on cups. Now, Frank doesn't see that he did that against Bournemouth in the Carabao Cup. He thinks he picked, and obviously some of the changes were enforced through injuries anyway. You know, but he still thoroughly believes he picked a side that should have been able to do a job in that game, and the fact that they didn't is on the players. And that, I think with the FA Cup, I don't think there'll be anything like that, unless they're in a scenario where injuries and things like that mean that they have to kind of be a little bit clever about who they pick and make a few sacrifices. You know, I think Frank understands the importance of the FA Cup to the club, to the fan base, and I think, obviously, it's a difficult one in the sense that is a very difficult game under any circumstances, but I've no doubt you'll take that very seriously.
Right, Joe, we will leave things there. I think, you know, we have chewed the fat enough. But for anyone who's not read any of Joe's stuff so far from Australia, then please head over to the Echo website and do so. And there'll be plenty more to come in the coming days and weeks as we build up for Everton's return to action on Boxing Day against Wolves. But for now, you have been listening to the Royal Blue podcast. Thank you very much for listening.
You've been listening to the Royal Blue podcast from the Liverpool Echo.